Production. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon, we are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear, Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you would best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and He shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is July 3rd, 2011, Sunday, and Bill Fink is with us for the second installment of the Great Sedition Trials. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh. And before we hop right into it, I think it merits pointing out that tomorrow is supposedly our Independence Day, and yet how many Americans realize just how unfree we truly are?
Well, if the government's taking, the average working, because both families have to work, right? I mean, both parents in most families have to work, right? And then, because they both have to work, usually because taxes are so high, they lose more of their income in taxes. And the average family, first they work until June to pay their taxes. They lose at least half of their income in direct taxes. And then, you know, property tax, income tax, state income tax, Social Security tax, unemployment tax, disability tax, and then on top of that, every product we buy, we're paying at least several hidden taxes behind, in addition to a sales tax. If you look at all the taxes in the society of the average couple making $75,000 to $100,000, they're easily paying 55 to 60% of their income in taxes, easily.
Absolutely.
And it's probably higher than that.
Whether it's overt sales tax or the hidden kosher tax.
Well, right. It's right. There's sales taxes, but there's all kinds of license fees, and there's all sorts of taxes, both direct taxes on products that are in the manufacturing process somewhere, or hidden taxes in the form of overburdensome regulation, where if you have to hire lawyers to deal with OSHA, the EPA, the EEOC, and all of these other agencies. Right, and you're probably paying 75% of your income in taxes when you look at all of that. And it's that's we're slaves. We're absolutely slaves. The people in this country, they're idiots for thinking they're free.
Even with simply
the income tax being at 33, 34, 35% for the average working couple, by the time they calculate everything up and make their dependents and pay their taxes. Well, the peons in the feudal system paid less. The tenant farmers in the feudal system paid less taxes than the average working couple does today. Far less taxes.
And I just wanted to say that the same man that gave us social insecurity and who gave us the National Labor Relations Act, which is, of course, is the National Labor Relations Board, that's what it established, is the same man who gave us these sedition trials that we're about to get into. It seems all of these horrible things came out of the almost 16-year-long regime of Franklin, President for Life, Rosenfeld. And I'm sure if he hadn't died, he would have been president for, another 20 years.
Well, in 1913, we gave a small cartel of Jewish banking families the rights to create all of the currency in our society. And when that happened, they wouldn't do that without a tax farming system in place, so that they could reap the benefits of our produce and our labor, and they have reaped nearly all the benefits of our produce and our labor ever since then. The Federal Reserve was instituted so that there would be no inflation, and when it was instituted, a loaf of bread may have cost 5 cents, and now it costs more like $5, and it's cheaper bread, right? It's far inferior than the product that was purchased 100 years ago. The inevitable result of having a small cartel of private bankers control and issue a nation's currency, which is exactly what's going on. I mean, the Treasury Department only prints it, right? It is that small cartel of private bankers ends up owning all of the property in the country. That's the inevitable result. It's totally unavoidable, and we're seeing the fruits of that now, where Americans don't own anything anymore.
Well, absolutely. They just print as much money as they want, and they use it to buy up the world, as long as people
accept
their funny money.
In New York, the average two-bedroom home, the real estate taxes are $6,000-$7,000 a year. It's incredible. So if you're making $60,000 a year, there's 10% of your income right to property taxes.
And if you think housing prices are ridiculous in New York, I saw in Britain a six-bedroom house was $6 million.
Right. A six-bedroom house would be out of reach here. I mean, a two-bedroom house is out of reach, right? It's property taxes, and property prices are ridiculous.
So property tax essentially assures that ownership is at best a dream or an ambition that someone has, but they can never quite reach it. Because if you retire, the government doesn't say, oh, well, you retired 3 years ago, so we're going to retire you on property tax. They want $6,000 every year, and you pay up or else.
Well, property tax basically assures that everybody has to be, all common people have to be involved in the corporate I can only liken it to a chattel slave system, right?
Mm-hmm.
We all have to have a job with the corporation or the state in order to assure that we could pay our property taxes. Basically, that's what it boils down to.
So you can't just farm, and when they say pay us $6,000, say, well, I don't have $6,000, but I'll pay you 200 bushels of corn. They're not interested in that.
Well, before the institution of these burdensome property taxes, which is a relatively new, property taxes were historically non-existent or extremely low for most of the history of our nation. And these last 50 years, property taxes have really skyrocketed. And before that, the average man with 10 acres didn't have to have a job to feed his family. All he had to have was a couple of cows or a couple of goats and supply milk and a few chickens, and he grew his own food. And the Jew... And the anathema of that to the Jew is that the man is independent of the Jewish financial system, and the Jew can't have that. And the financial system, the way the Jew has it set up, it is basically a pyramid scheme. Every dollar that comes into the economy, has to be paid back with interest, and that means that there's always more money outstanding in debt than there is money in circulation. And that's an evil system, and it's basically a pyramid scheme. And because of that, the Jew has to keep that pyramid scheme going. The only way to keep that pyramid scheme going is that the economy has to grow. And if the economy has to grow to keep the pyramid scheme going, that means that we have to have more and more people in the involved in this economy every year. And because our population, white population, has been either stable or shrinking, that's why they have to flood us with aliens. If they don't flood us with these aliens to keep the economy growing, the banks are going to start to collapse. And we're seeing that right now because the economy hasn't been growing these last 4 or 5 years. If the economy doesn't grow, banks have to collapse. Because it's a pyramid scheme.
Hmm.
Banks have to default. It's inevitable.
So they claim that so-called free enterprise, or what they call capitalism as a slur, they say that free enterprise has to grow into imperialism and it must expand because it uses up its own markets and it needs new markets. But really, their international finance capitalism, their Ponzi scheme has to expand, and their socialism has to expand, because as I said to Nico earlier, that socialism can work in one country as long as people in a productive country elsewhere underwrite it. You know how the Russian workers were paying for almost all the stuff that Albania and North Korea were receiving. And of course, we in America were underwriting socialism for the Soviets.
Well, absolutely. In America, we've underwritten socialism for half the world. It came out the other day on one of the mailing lists I subscribe to. Oh, it's the Council of Conservative Citizens that we've been basically funding La Raza with millions of dollars for several years now. So how more nefarious can a government get than that? Than to fund a people that this La Raza group is an extremist, anti-white group, and we've been funding them. Can you imagine the United States government funding neo-Nazis?
No.
Then why are we funding La Raza?
Unless it's an episode of The Twilight Zone.
Well, it's blatant. The anti-white climate in our own government, the Jew is so confident in his position that the government has become blatantly anti-white, and it's done that over the last 12, 15 years, and it's just incredible that people don't see it. They don't care. Every American doesn't care unless, as long as he has his little piece of the pie and thinks he could hold on to it, he doesn't care. And there's a whole lot of pies going to disappear all at once in this country, and people are going to wonder what the hell happened.
All right.
It all started with Woodrow Wilson, but I think that Franklin Roosevelt was the water over the dam. It was when we got to him, it was way too late to turn around, and that's
Wilson,
where we are now.
We had a few cracks in the facade of the dam and the face of the dam, and with FDR, it basically just burst. That was the end.
Oh, absolutely. It Woodrow Wilson set us up for this socialist system, but Franklin Roosevelt definitely implemented it. There's no doubt in my mind. Capitalism is the financial expression of Talmudism, but and as far as the Jew is concerned, and communism is the financial expression of Talmudism as far as the non-Jew is concerned. So in the end game for the Jew is that the Jews have all the money and they're the capitalists, and all of the goyim are slaves. And that's that's basically what happened in Bolshevik Russia. And we could see the proof of that when Russia fell apart. All of the property and all of the industrial property in Russia fell into the hands of 10 Jews.
All right. Would you like to
begin with the trial? Well, right now we are at the description of some of the people who fell victim to the sedition trial. The sedition trial was Franklin Roosevelt's way of shutting up all opposition to his wartime plans, right, against Germany, and his, I believe it extended to his post-war plans and how Europe was going to be divided, that he would ensure he had no opposition to any of that. And he brought all of these seemingly average Americans up on trial for sedition. And most of these people were average Americans. They were not rich, that they didn't draw a lot of attention because they weren't famous and they weren't moneyed. They were just average people, pamphleteers, small town newspaper editors who were writing in opposition to Franklin Roosevelt's wartime policies and even getting into the war. Some of them were America's First Committee members, and that was basically a nationwide organization of patriots who were against our involvement in wars in Europe. And some of them were just more or less average Joes that had published a pamphlet or a paper or written a letter. And they got caught up in this, and they were used by the Roosevelt administration as examples, I believe, to anybody else that would think about speaking out. These sedition trials went on for 3 years, and Roosevelt and his administration discouraged all opposition, I believe, through these sedition trials, which were absolutely un-American, unconstitutional, and tyrannical. The people should have been up in arms when these sedition trials occurred, because the charge of sedition was used as a wedge by a president who thought he was a king, so that he could silence all opposition and therefore destroy the right of freedom of speech in this country. And here we are at where Lawrence Dennis, and he was one of the victims of Roosevelt's sedition indictments. He was named, I think, in the third indictment, and here he's describing some of the people who were indicted in the sedition trials, and he's describing this one gentleman by the name of Elmer Garner of Wichita, Kansas, who was a small town newspaper publisher. He had a weekly little newspaper he used to send out to a subscription list, and it was pretty much harmless. And even though it opposed the government, it was pretty much harmless. And he was 83 years old, and we're in the middle of Lawrence Dennis's description of him. I'm going to start a couple of paragraphs ahead from where we were reading last week.
All right.
One of the defendants of the weaker, less influential, and less important, insignificant Americans targeted by FDR was Elmer J. Garner of Wichita, Kansas. This elderly American patriot died 3 weeks after the trial began. Senator William Langer, Republican, North Dakota, an angry critic of the trial, described the victim in a speech on the Florida Senate. Garner, he said, was a little old gentleman of 83, almost stone deaf, with three great-grandchildren, and he lost the mailing permit for his little weekly paper. He lived with his aged wife through small donations, keeping a goat and a few chickens and raising vegetables on his small home plot.
Well, of course, they paid him then.
I'm sorry?
I said, of course the Jews hate him then if he's living like that.
Well, right, because he's living independently of the Jews, right? Well, these are the kind of people that Franklin Roosevelt was indicting in the sedition trial in order to make an example and stifle his political opposition. We don't have any right under the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights, not that they're really worth anything. You know why they're not worth anything? Because people don't stand up for them. I should be willing to take up arms if I see your right to freedom of speech is oppressed by the government. That is tyranny. And even if I don't agree with what you're saying, I should be willing to take up arms to defend your right to say it.
Most people won't do that, though. They want people that have dissenting opinions to be suppressed.
Well, of course. And as soon as you allow another man's rights, God-given rights, the founders saw these as God-given rights, and what God has given, the government cannot take away. And that's why the founders included the Bill of Rights. Once I approve of you losing any of those rights, I don't deserve my own, and I'm bound to lose them. And we have in this country. We've lost many of our rights in this country, and we don't even realize it. And the general attitude of people in this country today is that those rights come from the government. Ask people in the street. Ask people in your family. Who gives you the right to keep and bear arms? They'll say the Constitution, or they'll say the government, one or the other. Both are wrong. Both answers are wrong. The right to keep and bear arms comes from God. Because it comes from God, man cannot take it away. The right to freedom of speech comes from God. Because it comes from God, man cannot take it away. That's the idea of the Bill of Rights. those rights, that's why they were called inalienable, meaning that you cannot be lawfully or rightfully separated from them for any reason. That's what inalienable means. Held in a Washington, D.C. jail for several weeks for lack of bond fees and finally impoverished by 3 indictments and 4 trips and stays in Washington, he died alone in a Washington rooming house early in his trial with 40 cents in his pocket. His body was shipped naked in a wooden box to his ailing impoverished widow, his 2 suits and typewriter being held so that clothing had to be purchased for his funeral. That is one of the dangerous men about whom we have been hearing so much. This is Lawrence Dennis talking about Elmer J. Garner, victim of Franklin Roosevelt's oppression. According to attorney Henry Klein, an American Jew who defied the ADL. There's always one self-hating Jew in the bunch, right?
Well, I wonder if he defied the ADL, or did they tell him, hey, we want a Jew on each side of this?
Well, that could very well be, and that could very likely be. We always have to keep that in mind. It's a very good point. According to attorney Henry Klein, an American Jew who defied the ADL by boldly serving as defense counsel for another of the defendants, and we've seen this over and over again, right? And we saw Roy Kahn on the side of the good, the conservatives in the McCarthy hearings, right?
Why would a conservative who's supposedly wise to what the Jews are up to go in the court with a Jew?
Well, right. I could never understand why McCarthy would have Roy Kahn. And I still don't entirely understand that, unless it's true, and somebody brought this to my attention a few months ago in an email, that possibly McCarthy was taking his instructions from Bernard Baruch, which is very possible. Okay, according to Henry Klein, an American Jew who defied the ADL by boldly serving as a defense counsel for another of the defendants, Garner, who was a first cousin of FDR's first vice president, John Nance Garner, died at his typewriter in a tiny room in a Washington flop house typing out his defense. Who was it then that brought about the series of events that led to the indictment of Elmer Garner and his both more distinguished and perhaps even less distinguished fellow seditionists? It was, of course, Franklin D. Roosevelt, who ordered the Justice Department investigation, Attorney General Francis Biddle, who opposed this blatantly political prosecution, followed the president's orders. I would think Francis Biddle was a coward. He should have resigned. And Assistant Attorney General William Power Maloney handled the day-to-day details of the investigation that won the indictments before a federal grand jury in Washington. But behind the scenes, there were other forces at work. The power brokers who dictated the overall grand design of the Roosevelt administration and its foreign and domestic policies. If Francis Biddle had courage, he'd have resigned and he'd have stated openly and publicly that the reason for his resignation was Franklin Roosevelt's tyranny in forcing him to prosecute these people. I would not, it's not conscionable that a man with any backbone at all wouldn't stand up to this tyranny. And because people didn't stand up to this tyranny, we have what we have today.
And it seems that Biddle never stood up to Rosenfeld. He basically caved time and time again and just went along to get along.
Well, right. And just a resignation would have been impossible at that level of government to keep out of the paper. And then every American would have known that Biddle resigned because Roosevelt was using his office for political purposes and using the courts for political purposes. In a trial on trial, his sharply written critique of the trial, which is a veritable dissection of the fraud that the trial represented, Lawrence Dennis and his co-author, Maximilian St. George, who was Dennis's counsel during the trial, although Dennis was not an attorney, he did most of the legal work himself. He concluded, based upon very readily available evidence in the public record, that the three prime movers behind the trial were, in his words, extreme leftists, organized Jewish groups, and internationalists in general.
All of whom were Jews.
Right. Yes, absolutely. All of whom were loud and persistent advocates of the trial, editorializing in favor of the investigation and indictments in their newspapers and through media voices such as radio personality Walter Winchell, who was also a Jew. However, Dennis pointed out, the internationalists behind the trial are not as easy to link with definite agitation for this prosecution as are the leftists and the Jewish groups. Dennis stated unequivocally, one of the most important Jewish organizations behind the sedition trial was the B'nai B'rith, referring specifically to the B'nai B'rith adjunct known as the Anti-Defamation League, or ADL. According to Dennis, getting the federal government to stage such a trial, like getting America into the war, was a must on the agenda of the fighters against isolationism and anti-Semitism. What the people behind the trial wanted to have judicially certified to the world was that anti-Semitism is a Nazi idea, and that anyone holding this idea is a Nazi, and they still label people who speak against the Jews today as anti-Semites and Nazis.
Whether or not they're a Nazi or not.
Who is thereby violating the law, in this instance, by causing insubordination in the armed forces through his belief in or advocacy of this idea. Well, now Jews are labeling all Christians as Nazis. They label all Christians as Nazis because Jews understand that a Christian is supposed to be anti-Jewish. Christianity is anti-Jewish if Christians would only read their New Testament. This was not just Dennis's conclusion by any means. One of the other defendants, David Baxter, later pointed out that the United Press report published in 1943 said, under pressure from Jewish organizations, to judge from articles appearing in publications put out by Jews for Jews, the indictment was drawn to include criticisms of Jews as sedition. And you know, they still pull the same tactic today. And I like to always explain it and use Michael Savage, the talk radio host, for an example. He plays the part of a right-wing conservative. He has probably 95% of a true conservative message down pat. He sounds real good when he talks about culture and illegal immigration, but he equates anti-Semitism with anti-Americanism. And for that reason, and that's why I believe he exists, he has millions of conservative Americans thinking that anti-Semitism is evil because it's anti-American. And that's why Michael Savage exists, to keep the most conservatives, mainstream conservatives, on the side of the Jews and have them believe that good Jews are conservative. It appeared that the main purpose of the whole procedure, along with outlawing unfavorable comments on the administration, was to set a legal precedent of judicial interpretations and severe penalties, which would serve to exempt Jews in America from all public mention except praise. And we see that they affected, even though they failed in the sedition trial, they still affected that today through the media and the excoriation of people like skinheads and neo-Nazis and taking a few small cases and blowing them far out of proportion and their own perfidy and treachery, because most swastikas on synagogues are actually drawn by rabbis.
And they're backwards.
Well, right, they're backwards too, and we've seen all that. We've seen all this come into fruition today. Everything that they wanted to do back in the Roosevelt administration, and Americans knew many of these America First people that they were readers of Henry Ford, the international Jew. We had people like Elizabeth Dilling who understood that Franklin Roosevelt was a communist who was aligning his administration with communists and pushing surreptitiously for a communist agenda in America, and she fully identified those communists. They were all Jews, and these people knew it, and the Jews had to contain that. The ADL is basically the public relations arm of the world's oldest crime ring, and that their sole purpose is to cover for Jewish treachery and Jewish crimes. That's the entire purpose of the ADL.
Well, unless I'm mistaken, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith formed to defend that Jew, what was it, Leo Frank, who presumably, it looks like he raped and murdered Mary Fagan in Georgia. If I'm not mistaken,
yes, he did.
That's when the ADL formed. And he tried to blame a Negro, claiming it wasn't his actions that led to the girl dying. It was some Negro factory worker.
Well, right, but it's grown to the point where today the ADL, a Jewish religious organization, which is formed out of a secret Masonic lodge, which is what B'nai B'rith is, the ADL has actually rose to become the primary instructor of American law enforcement in matters of religion.
So much for the First Amendment.
And so much for the First Amendment, right. Under pressure from Jewish organizations to judge from articles appearing in publications put out by Jews for Jews, the indictment was drawn to include criticisms of Jews as, quote-unquote, sedition. It appeared that the main purpose of the whole procedure, along with outlawing unfavorable comments on the administration, was to set a legal precedent of judicial interpretations and severe penalties which would serve to exempt Jews in America from all public mention except praise. I'm sorry, I've read this already, but it deserves to be read again. In contrast to the traditional American viewpoint, which holds that all who take part in public affairs must be ready to accept full free public discussion, either pro or con. In a word, commented Lawrence Dennis, the sedition trial is politics. It was smart, it was good politics. Baxter himself determined in later years that certain Jewish groups, specifically the ADL, had been prime movers behind the Justice Department investigation that resulted in the indictments of the defendants in the sedition trial. According to Baxter, commenting many years later, I demanded, this is Baxter's words, I demanded through the Freedom of Information Act that the FBI turn over to me its investigation records of my activities during the early 1940s leading up to the sedition trial. I learned that the investigation had extended over several years and covered hundreds of pages. The FBI blocked out the names of those who had given information about me, much of it false as anything could be. I was never given a chance to face these people and make them prove their accusations, which is a total infringement on constitutional right, the Sixth Amendment right to face your accuser and have a fair trial. Yet everything they said went into the investigation records. Oddly enough, in a great many cases, it wasn't the FBI that conducted the investigation, but the Anti-Defamation League, with the FBI merely receiving the reports of the ADL investigators. One can hardly tell from the reports whether a given person was an FBI agent or an ADL agent. But at the time, all this was so hush-hush that I didn't even suspect the web spinning going on around me. I hadn't considered myself that important. For his own part, commenting on the way that the FBI had been used by the ADL, for example, Lawrence Dennis pointed out the FBI, like the atomic bomb and so many other useful and dangerous tools, is an instrument around the use of which new safeguards against abuse by unscrupulous interests must soon be created. There's an editor's note here that says, to our shame, Americans did not learn that lesson in light of FBI intrigue alongside the ADL, later exposed in the course of such controversies as the Holocaust at Waco, the slaughter of the Weaver family members at Ruby Ridge, Idaho, and the mysterious Oklahoma City bombing. That's a note from John Tiffany. Writing in his 1999 book, Montana's Last Cause, a study of Senator Burton Wheeler and other members of Montana's congressional delegation who opposed the Roosevelt administration's war in Europe, historian Roger Roots also points out another fascinating cog in the behind-the-scenes maneuvering that led to the sedition trial. Here's a quote from Roots. The Jewish-owned Washington Post, which was actually bought by a Jew named Eugene Meyer at a bankruptcy sale in 1933. The Jewish-owned Washington Post assisted in the detective work of the Justice Department from the beginning. Dillard Stokes, the Post columnist, who was most conspicuous in his insider reporting of the sedition grand jury proceedings, actually became part of the Justice Department's case against the isolationists when he wrote requests to numerous of the defendants to send their literature to him under an assumed name. It was this that allowed defendants to be brought from the farthest reaches of the country into the jurisdiction of the Federal District Court in Washington, D.C. So we see that the a Washington Post columnist wrote all of these people who were pamphleteers and small-town newspaper producers and asked them to send him copies of their articles, and they did, and because he was in Washington, D.C., that's how the government made it so that they could try these people in Washington, D.C. But this was a private person doing this, a newspaper columnist doing this, and not a government agent. But that's
he solicited them, he entrapped them.
Yes. David Baxter elaborated on a role played by Post columnist Stokes, who used the pseudonym Jefferson Bream in order to obtain some of the allegedly seditious literature that had been published by some of the defendants. And David Baxter says, in order to try us in Washington as a group, Baxter being one of the co-defendants, it was necessary to establish that a crime had been committed in the District of Columbia, thus giving jurisdiction to the federal courts there. So the grand jury, which was obviously controlled by the prosecution, charged us with the crime of sedition and then established District of Columbia jurisdiction to try us on the grounds that a District of Columbia resident, this Stokes posing as Jefferson Bream, had received the allegedly seditious literature. There thus was the alleged crime committed in the Capitol. The defendants were charged with having conspired in the District of Columbia, despite the fact that I had never been in Washington, meaning Baxter, in my life until ordered there by the grand jury. And it's incredible also because sedition, as they've spelled out, it is the act of agitating the law, the armed forces against the nation. And here, it's only a newspaper columnist who receives some papers in the mail, right? That's far from agitating the armed forces. It's incredible that the pretense they used to claim jurisdiction in this trial is just absurd. Kirkpatrick Dilling, now an attorney in Chicago, but then a young man in uniform and the son of one of the more prominent defendants, Elizabeth Dilling, pointed out in a letter to the Barnes Review publisher Willis Carlo that, quote, my mother was indicted with many others, most of whom she had never any contact with whatsoever. So the charges of conspiracy are false, right? For example, some of such co-indictees were members of the German-American Bund. My mother said they were included to give the case a sauerkraut flavor. Later during the trial itself, the aforementioned Senator Langer scored what he described as the idea of bringing together for one trial in Washington 30 people who never saw each other, who never wrote to each other, some of whom did not know that the others existed, with some of them allegedly insane and the majority of them unable to hire a lawyer. And remember, Langer pointed out, the senator, the defendants were brought to Washington from California and Illinois and other states a long way from Washington, placed in one room and all tried at the same time, with the 29 sitting idly by while the testimony against one of them may go on for weeks and weeks and weeks. The testimony of a man or woman whom the other defendants never saw before in their lives. That is what is taking place in Washington here today. And as we discussed last week, it basically tied up all of these people who otherwise may have been writing and publishing things about the war and the administration. So they basically just put these people in a different sort of prison for 3 years, whether or not they were ever convicted, because being in this environment for 3 years is being in prison. It is just like being in prison. As mentioned previously, there were actually three indictments handed down. The first indictment came on July 21st, 1942. The indictments came as a surprise to more than a few people, including the defendants. As David Baxter said, actually, at that time, I was simply a New Deal Democrat interested in what was going on in the country politically. But as a consequence of the indictment, he was being accused of sedition by the very regime he had once supported. Elizabeth Dilling learned of her indictment on the radio. The nature of one of the charges against Mrs. Dilling exposes precisely how trumped up the sedition trial was from the start. The indictment charged that Mrs. Dilling had committed sedition by reprinting in the pages of her newsletter a speech in Congress by Representative Claire Hoffman, a Republican from Michigan, an administration critic, in which the congressman quoted an American soldier in the Philippines who complained his outfit lacked bombers because the planes had been given to Britain. This ostensibly was dangerous to military morale. But Mrs. Dilling's many supporters around the country rose to her defense, raising money through dances, dinners, and bake sales. Mrs. Dilling, ever courageous.
Oh, Bill, isn't that how her supporters would have to raise the money? They can't just print it off the printing press like the Federal Reserve.
No, like the Jews do. Mrs. Dilling, ever courageous, would not let even a federal criminal indictment silence her. She still continued to speak out. We should probably do a program on some of her writing one night. On August 17, 1942, Senator Robert A. Taft spoke out against the indictment. He said, "I am deeply alarmed by the growing tendency to smear loyal citizens who are critical of the national administration and of the conduct of the war." Which is an under-response, if I ever heard one, right? "Something very close to fanaticism exists in certain circles. I cannot understand it, cannot grasp it, but I am sure of this. Freedom of speech itself is at stake unless the general methods pursued by the Justice Department are changed." Well, they still haven't changed. Taft noted that the indictment, in his words, was adroitly drawn, and said it claimed that such groups as the Coalition of Patriotic Societies were linked to the accused conspirators. Today they just use the slur neo-Nazis, right? The coalition, Taft noted, or Christian Identity, included among its member organizations such groups as the Descendants of the Signers of the Declaration of Independence, the General Society of Mayflower Descendants, and the Sons of the American Revolution, among others. "On the basis of the way in which the indictment was written," Taft said, "a considerable number of members of both the House and Senate could also be indicted, along with a considerable number of the nation's newspaper editors." Well, the Jews did, in fact, replace them all, right? One of the major media figures promoting the prosecution of the alleged American seditionist was popular radio broadcasting legend Walter Winchell. Who made him a legend? He was an Eastern European Jew, right? Do you have the scoop on Winchell?
So I suppose he's a legend in his own mind.
Yeah, right. Who was also an influential newspaper columnist. What millions of listeners and readers did not know was that behind Winchell pulling his strings was Arnold Forster, the New York counsel and chief fact finder for the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, which itself was otherwise a very public supporter of the sedition trial. Oftentimes, according to Winchell's biographer, Neil Gabler, Forster himself drafted entire columns for Winchell and, in addition, appeared on Winchell's radio studio to edit Winchell's radio broadcasts. What's more, Winchell often acted as the ADL's conduit to the FBI, providing the ADL's quote-unquote facts to the FBI that were used in the prosecution of the alleged seditionists. An overview of Winchell's covert connections appeared in an article by Michael Collins Piper in the August 1998 issue of the Bond Review, and I'll try to pull them out maybe if I can obtain them. I don't even know if I had that issue. It's kind of old, but I'll try to pull them out for a future edition of this program. The second indictment came on January 4th, 1943. Lawrence Dennis summarized the nature of the indictments. Quote, "The first indictment charged conspiracy to violate the seditious propaganda sections of both the Wartime Espionage Act of 1917 and the Peacetime Smith Act of 1940, sometimes called the Alien Registration Act. This indictment," too bad we don't have one of those in effect now, right? "This indictment was that the defendants had conspired to spread Nazi propaganda for the purpose of violating the just mentioned laws. The government case consisted of showing the similarity between the propaganda themes of the Nazis and the defendants." However, as Dennis pointed out, for a conviction of such an indictment to stand under law, it is necessary to prove similarity of intent of the persons accused rather than similarity of the content of what they said.
So they would have to prove that these people intended to commit sedition and intended to weaken morale.
Well, right. And all they really did was intend to tell the truth, because the Nazis were telling the truth about the Jews, too. The weaknesses of these first two indictments were that they fitted neither the law nor the evidence. The government's difficulty was that, to please the people behind the trial, it had to indict persons whose only crime was isolationism, anti-Semitism, and anti-communism, when there was no law on the statute books against these isms. The two laws chosen for the first two indictments penalized advocacy of the overthrow of the government by force and of insubordination in the armed forces. Several new defendants were added with the second indictment. Among them was Frank Clark. Considering the charge that Clark and the others had been conspiring to undermine the morale of the American military, it was worth noting that Clark was a highly decorated veteran of World War I who was wounded 8 times in action. This is how he's repaid, right? Clark had been an organizer for the famous Bonus March of World War I veterans to Washington in the 1920s.
Well, I'm sure if he'd have been willing to, they would have used him as a poster child for selling war bonds or sending Americans overseas. They wouldn't have hesitated to use him as a whore if he let them use him as a whore, but because he speaks for patriotism, suddenly his service doesn't matter anymore and he's insubordinate.
And we see the same thing in society today. It's the same, because the same people are in charge of the government, right?
The neocons treat you like crap unless you were in the service, and then even if you were in the service, unless you agree with them, they still treat you like crap.
He lobbied for early payment of veterans bonuses that had been promised to the war veterans returning home a hero. When arrested, he lacked enough money to hire a lawyer. They should have paid him his veterans bonus. Then another Jew would have had a job. All of this, however, meant nothing in the course of the ongoing effort by the Roosevelt administration to silence its critics and to prevent more and more Americans from speaking out. Throughout this period, the major media was rife with reports of how a group of Americans in league with Hitler and the German National Socialists were trying to destroy America from within, and how the Roosevelt administration was brave.
The Roosevelt administration was bravely taking on this conspiracy.
However, the Justice Department has made a misstep and the second indictment, like this.
Oh, Bill, I can't hear you. Your volume went down to virtually inaudible.
Yes, I lost my audio. Can you hear me now?
Yes, perfectly. 5x5.
Sorry about that. All of this, however, meant nothing in the course of the ongoing effort by the Roosevelt administration to silence its critics and to prevent more and more Americans from speaking out. Throughout this period, the major media was rife with reports of how a group of Americans in league with Hitler and the German National Socialists were trying to destroy America from within, and how the Roosevelt administration was bravely taking on this conspiracy. However, the Justice Department had made a misstep in the second indictment, and the second indictment, like the first, was thrown out. The charges had nothing to do with what they had actually done. That there was nothing at all that these acts that they indicted them under had nothing at all to do with anything these people did, and that's the gall of the Justice Department, that they could do this to people and have them spend all this time and all their resources fighting a case like this, but when the Justice Department has egg on its face, nobody pays for it. That nobody on the government side is penalized for it. And that's that they can do basically anything they want to anybody as long as they don't suffer when they're found to be wrong. In the Hebrew law, when a man raised a false accusation against somebody and the accusation was proven to be false, that man paid the penalty under the law that the person who was accused would have paid if he were found guilty.
They said what he said to his brother should be done unto him.
And that severely cut the number of malicious prosecutions, I'm sure.
But there's no penalty
for
malicious prosecution in this country.
I'm sure that if the penalty for malicious prosecution in this country was anything like the biblical law, we probably wouldn't have any malicious prosecutions, and we'd have a lot of upright, honest prosecutors, I'm certain. But they pay no penalty. As Roger Roots notes, the indictment was unlawful. It was discarded due to the obvious absence of evidence for conviction, among other flaws. Past Supreme Court decisions clearly showed that a conviction for advocating the overthrow of the government by violent force must include some evidence of the actual plans to use violence, not just political literature. Again, the indictment was never dismissed, but formally simply retired, so that they never even had to admit their maliciousness or their wrongdoing. Senator Burton Wheeler, in particular, was a harsh critic of the Justice Department and publicly made clear his intention. As the new head of the Senate Judiciary Committee following the 1942 elections, to keep a close watch on the affair as it unfolded. As far as the legal procedures used in the first two indictments, he declared, if it happened in most jurisdictions of this country, the prosecuting attorneys would be held for contempt of court. Well, that's nice, and it's a quaint saying, but have you ever heard of a prosecutor held for contempt of court?
I would say
for indicting?
Contempt of Constitution.
Yeah, right. This, thus, despite all the determined efforts of the Justice Department and its allies in the Anti-Defamation League and at the Washington Post, the first two indictments were indeed thrown out as defective. On March 5, 1943, Judge Jesse C. Adkins dismissed the count in the indictment that accused the defendants of conspiring together on or about the first day of January 1933 and continuously thereafter up to and including the date of the filing of the indictment, since, as the judge held, the law which the defendants were accused of conspiring to violate had not been enacted until 1940. At this juncture, under pressure from Senator Wheeler, Attorney General Biddle agreed to remove Prosecutor William Maloney as the chief, quote-unquote, Nazi hunter. Well, this didn't do much good because the prosecutor that took his place was 100 times worse. Thus, a new Justice Department prosecutor entered into the place, O. John Rogue. And Rogue, it's probably Roga, but I'll pronounce it Rogue because that's a good name for him. As Defendant David Baxter pointed out, Rogue was a fitting choice for the administration's chief point man in this Soviet-style show trial. Quote, it later turned out that Rogue had been a good friend of Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin, was involved in numerous communist front groups, and had visited Russia, where he spoke in the Kremlin and laid a wreath at the grave of American Communist Party co-founder John Reed in Red Square. His wreath was inscribed, in loving memory from grateful Americans. Rogue was an American delegate to a World Communist Peace Conference in Paris and was a lawyer for many communists in trouble with the law. He was the attorney for David Greenglass, the atomic spy who saved his own life by turning state's evidence against his sister and brother-in-law, Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, who went to the electric chair for turning over U.S. atomic secrets to the Soviets. Rogue was thus eventually exposed for what he was. No wonder he was so fanatical in his hatred against the sedition trial defendants, all of whom were anti-communists. Rogue was an ideal choice for the Roosevelt administration and its allies, who were determined to pursue the prosecution one way or the other. He moved forward relentlessly. As Roger Roots points out, not wishing to waste momentum, the government reconvened another grand jury, which would be the third. We submitted the same pamphlets, publications, and materials that the previous grand jury had already seen. We called the same testimony of the witnesses and once again pleaded the grand jury to return yet another indictment. The third and final indictment was handed down on January 3rd, 1944. In fact, Rogue and his Justice Department allies had decided to take a new tack and added 8 new names, including Lawrence Dennis, who had not been named in the first indictments, and dismissed 12 defendants who had been named, who'd been named previously in the second and first indictments. Among those whose names were dismissed were influential New York Catholic lay leader William Griffin and his newspaper. They actually indicted a newspaper in a second indictment, the New York Evening Enquirer, the only publication which was indicted. Former American diplomat Ralph Townsend of San Francisco and Washington, D.C., and Paquita de Shishmaref, the well-to-do American-born widow of a former Russian czarist military figure. Townsend, who had enraged the Roosevelt administration by opposing its anti-Japanese policies in the Pacific, had written an explosive book, Ways That Are Dark, highly critical of Imperial China. But although he was now free, he and his family had been broken financially by the indictment.
And that's pretty much what the focus of these indictments happens to be.
If you
can't convict a person, break him and ruin him.
Absolutely. That's what it's all about, because that's what they do. And according to his late wife, Janet, many of their close friends deserted them in this time of crisis, and I've experienced that also, right? That's exactly what happens, is the people they claim that cling to you to be your best friends in times of success and plenty, well, when you face a time of trial, that they just desert you. And it's incredible. It was a very difficult period in our lives, Janet Townsend later recalled, but it didn't prevent Ralph from continuing to speak out. Townsend did continue to speak out, and in later years he became a friend of Willis A. Cardo, publisher of the Barnes Review, and today portions of Townsend's personal library are part of the Barnes Review archives. Tony Blizzard, who is now research director for Liberty Lobby, the Washington-based populist institution, let me say that that's affiliated with the Barnes Review, was a protege in the early 1960s of Paquita de Shishmaref, who actually wrote as L. Fry, a pen name, and he recently commented on the circumstances surrounding the decision to drop the indictment against her, along with some fascinating little-known details about this remarkable woman. In Blizzard's informed estimation, quote, "One of the reasons they dropped the indictment against Maddie de Shishmaref was precisely because they knew they were dealing with a very sharp lady with a great deal of brain power, a woman of the old school. Maddie would never put herself at the forefront, but she knew how to use the strengths of the men around her. She was also a woman of some means, unlike most of the other defendants, and was a formidable opponent." I wonder how they let her out of Russia. "The government clearly decided that it was in their best interests to dismiss the case against her. There was no way they could ever make Nazis out of all of these defendants whose only real crime was exposing Jewish power as long as Maddie was on the dock with the rest of them. The prosecutors knew quite well, although it was not widely known then, nor is it widely known today, that it was Maddie who had supplied Henry Ford virtually all of the information Ford had published in his controversial series about Jewish power in the Dearborn Independent. With her wide-ranging high-level connections, Maddie was an encyclopedic storehouse of inside information about the power elite. The last thing the prosecution wanted was for Maddie to take the stand. By releasing her as a defendant, they eliminated to them what was a very frightening possibility." I wonder why they indicted her in the first place, right, if she had the means to sustain it. "But there were 30 others who were not so lucky as Paquita Maddie de Shishmaref, Ralph Townsend, and the others who had been released, and their trial commenced on April 17, 1944, in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. Kirkpatrick Dilling, son of Elizabeth Dilling, captured the essence of the indictment. According to Dilling, the indictment was premised on an alleged conspiracy to undermine the morale of the armed forces, thus criticizing President Roosevelt, who was Armed Forces Commander-in-Chief, who as Armed Forces Commander-in-Chief was an alleged overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy. Denouncing our ally, Communist Soviet Russia, was a further alleged overt act. Opposing communism was an alleged overt act because our enemy Hitler had also opposed communists."
Enemy Hitler? We weren't at war yet.
Well, this is 1944.
Oh, Pat, I wasn't sure that was... Oh, that was when this was written. Okay.
Well, we really weren't at war when the events happened under which that the original indictment was what was obtained, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because those events supposedly took place in 1940. We weren't officially at war until the end of 1941. And that indictment was
down
in 1942.
An 18-month delay in the time of the so-called incident and then the indictment.
Well, right, but it's absolutely it's absolutely evident here that the Jews were making up the charges for the prosecutor as they went along.
So if somebody said something nice about Hitler in 1931, suddenly in 1943, oh, we're at war with Hitler now, so sedition, look what you said 12 years ago.
Well, basically, that's what this boils down to. "Ironically, while his mother was on trial for alleged participation in this conspiracy to undermine the morale of the armed forces, Kirkpatrick Dilling was promoted from corporal to second lieutenant in the U.S. Army. Other defendants, including George Sylvester Vyrick, George Betheridge, Robert Noble, and Reverend Gerald Winrod, who also had sons in the United States Armed Forces during this period. Vyrick's son died in combat while his father was on trial and in prison." There's a side note here. Two of the leading critics of the Roosevelt administration's war policies were North Dakota's Republican Senator Gerald Nye and famed aviator Charles A. Lindbergh. According to sedition trial defendants Lawrence Dennis, and in a judgment of all other independent observers, the only reason that FDR's Justice Department did not bring sedition charges against such big-name critics as Nye and Lindbergh was precisely because the administration knew that it could never carry it and that there would be major political repercussions as a consequence. The September 1996 issue of Barnes Review featured commentary from Nye and Lindbergh on the international crises of that period. And that's another issue that I don't even know is obtainable, right? I would have to look into it. Presiding as judge at the trial was ex-Iowa Democratic Congressman C. Eicher, a New Deal stalwart who had served a brief period as chairman of FDR's Securities and Exchange Commission after being defeated for re-election to Congress. After Eicher's term at the SEC, FDR then appointed Eicher to the judgeship, and serving as prosecutor was Eicher's former legal counsel at the SEC, the aforementioned O. John Rogue. So we had a known communist as legal counsel at the SEC. Imagine that in the Roosevelt administration. I would have never guessed. It seemed that the case was fixed from top to bottom. Albert Dilling, the attorney who represented his wife, Elizabeth Dilling, called for a congressional investigation of the trial on the grounds that it was impossible for such a trial to be fair during wartime, but that was not enough to stop the trial juggernaut. Although proving sedition was the ostensible purpose of the prosecution, Lawrence Dennis reached other conclusions about the actual political basis for the trial. He says, "The trial was conceived and staged as a political instrument of propaganda and intimidation against certain ideas and tendencies which are popularly spoken of as isolationism, anti-communism, and anti-Semitism. The biggest single idea of the trial was that of linking Nazism with isolationism and anti-Semitism and with anti-communism. However, as Dennis pointed out, quote, American isolationism was born with George Washington's farewell address."
He's an anti-Semite and a Nazi. We better put him on trial.
Right. Washington actually had warned us not to get involved in European wars, right, in foreign wars. Not with anything the Nazis ever penned. As for anti-Semitism, it has flourished since the dawn of Jewish history. It is as old and widespread as the Jews. As for the anti-communism, while it was one of Hitler's two or three biggest ideas, this is Lawrence Dennis writing, right? It is in no way peculiar to Hitler or the Nazis any more than anti-capitalism is peculiar to the Russian communists. To add shock value to the indictment, the government, in an accompanying bill of particulars, which was basically a rehash of the history of the Nazi Party in Germany, named German Chancellor Adolf Hitler as a co-conspirator. During the trial, prosecutor Rogue charged that Hitler had picked the defendants to head a Nazi occupation government in the United States once Germany won the war, which is totally ludicrous, right? What the prosecutor was essentially trying to do, according to Lawrence Dennis, was to perfect a formula to convict people for doing what was against no law. Boiled down.
Were to believe that Hitler picked an 83-year-old man who was mostly deaf. He picked a bricklayer from Detroit and a maid.
Yes.
And this was to be the occupation
government. National socialism, right. It's ludicrous. It boiled down to choosing a crime which the Department of Justice would undertake to prove equaled anti-Semitism, anti-communism, and isolationism. The crime chosen was causing insubordination in the armed forces. The law was the Smith Act, which had been enacted in 1940. As Dennis pointed out, one of the many ironies of the mass sedition trial was that the defendants were charged with conspiring to violate a law aimed at the communists and of using a communist tactic, that of trying to undermine the loyalty of the armed forces. What makes this so ironic is the fact that many of the defendants, being fanatical anti-communists, had openly supported the enactment of this law. Defendant David Baxter later recalled, quote, "After Hitler and Stalin concluded a treaty, American communists enthusiastically endorsed those of us who opposed getting into the European war between Germany and the British-French alliance. The communists even stomached the Jewish issue that some of us raised, and many Jewish communists who wanted the United States to join the war against Hitler left their party. All that changed overnight, however, when war broke out between Germany and Russia. The communists then turned against us with a vengeance and eagerly backed FDR and American participation in the war to save the Soviets," which is exactly what it was. Lawrence Dennis's assessment of the government's case is reminiscent of that of Kirkpatrick Dilling. Quote, "The pattern of the prosecution gradually emerged something like this. Our country is at war. Russia is our ally. The Russian government is communist. These defendants fight communism. They are therefore weakening the ties between the two countries. This is interfering with the war efforts. This is in turn injuring the morale of the armed forces. The indictees should therefore be sent to prison." Henry Klein, an outspoken Jewish anti-communist, was the attorney who represented defendant Eugene Sanctuary.
What do the anti-communist Jews advocate instead of communism? I hear about all these anti-communist Jews, but they never advocate American patriotism or Christianity.
Well, no, but they advocate Talmudism and capitalism anyway. I mean, capitalism is a perversion of the free enterprise system that basically puts all the world's property into the hands of the usurious Jews.
So it's basically an anti-communist Jew just means that a Jew who is on the other side of the so-called left-right debate.
Basically.
He's there to make sure that the Jews are represented on both sides of the table.
The dichotomy is absolutely false.
Not to mention that
take a good look at communist Russia. Jews controlled all of the property in Russia during the communist regime.
If one or two Jews openly and overtly oppose communism, then the Jews can say, see, not all Jews are communists. It's the same thing with gun control in this country. 98% of Jews want to ban every gun except the ones in their hands and the police's hands, and yet we have one or two Jews that say, oh no, we support the Second Amendment, so they can hold themselves up as examples of, here we are, we're Jews and we don't support a gun ban. Isn't that how the Jews always work a debate?
Absolutely. They love playing both sides. Henry H. Klein, an outspoken Jewish anti-communist, was the attorney who represented defendant Eugene Sanctuary, and that's an odd name, and he took issue with the very constitutionality of the trial. This alleged indictment, thundered Klein in his opening address to the jury, is under the peacetime statute, not under the Wartime Act, and the writings and speeches of these defendants were made when this nation was at peace and under a constitution which guarantees free press and free speech at all times, including during wartime, until the constitution is suspended, and it has not yet been suspended, or so he thought. These people believed in the guarantees set forth in the constitution, and they criticized various acts of the administration. About his own client, Klein noted, he is 73 years old and devoutly religious. He and his wife ran the Presbyterian Foreign Mission Office in New York City for many years, and he has written and published several hundred sacred and patriotic songs. One of those songs, Klein noted, was Uncle Sam, We Are Standing By You, and was published in June of 1942, well after the war had begun. Hardly the actions of a dangerous seditionist that the prosecution and the sympathetic press painted Sanctuary to be. I think there's probably a pretty good place to break in this article, because we're only about halfway through it, and we'll definitely run into next week.
All
but
right.
It's obvious that the sedition trial was a political farce, and represented a government with very tyrannical leanings, to say the least. I mean, that there's no doubt that the Roosevelt administration had become a tyranny, and that's how they got away with this. It's my biggest disappointment so far, though, is that Francis Biddle, who, if he really believed this was an unjust trial, should have resigned. And that would have brought negative light and opened up questions in the media. In a noble government, a noble servant of government would resign in such a situation in order to protest. That's how noble men protested.
And bring attention to an outrage.
Well, right, exactly. And he's like you said last week, he's just a careerist, and even though he opposed it, he went along with it because he cares more about his own hide, his own career, his own belly, than he cared about the people who were being treated so unjustly. He was the one in the best position, I think, to do something about it if he opposed it, and he did nothing.
And we have a lot of those people today, don't we?
Well, today we have a whole government full of those people. Well, we have an entire government full of those people, those same people. They're all Francis Biddles. That they know what the government's doing is wrong, but they don't care. They're getting their paycheck.
If they don't get their paycheck, maybe then they might resign in protest. That would probably be what it takes
Absolutely. When their paycheck becomes totally worthless, that because the dollar is worth a tenth of a penny instead of just a penny, that then maybe they'll start to wake up. It's I don't know how bad it has to get in this nation before people do start to wake up, but obviously it's not anywhere near as bad as it will get.
So people will go set off their fireworks tomorrow, oblivious to the fact that, one, we gained our independence from the British, and two, we don't really have any independence or freedom anymore, and three, if you speak out too much, you'll wind up on trial for sedition.
And even worse, the fireworks are made in China.
And the flag's made in Mexico.
Right, well, then. Praise Yahweh, in the end we will prevail. All odds seem against us, but we will prevail, there's no doubt.
See you next week, then. Yah bless.
Yah bless.